طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. Ali Abu Nima is a second-generation Palestinian journalist and a founder and the driving force of the Electronic Intifada. He is one of the strongest proponents of the one-state solution and the BDS movement and a prolific Palestinian voice speaking throughout the world. This morning, we feature a presentation he gave at Bowdoin University as a guest of the student group Students for Justice in Palestine. It will take our entire time, so let's get right to it. Here is Palestinian journalist Ali Abu Nima speaking at Bowdoin University.
Thank you, Simon.
I definitely want to touch on. Now, since I've been on campus and walked around this really beautiful and lovely place, I've noticed doesn't make Bowdoin unique, but there are a lot of statues and chiseled names and paintings in the hallways. And I think every single one of them I've seen has been the statue or the name or the image of a white man. And they tend to have very grim faces, too. I mean, they very rarely smile. And now that's not something that makes Bowdoin stand out, but it is a feature of the way our country's history is told, and to a great extent how our present is and future is told. I recently started rewatching, since now you can get everything on your iPad pretty much for free, rewatching old episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation. Who watches that? Good. All right. And which I love, and I've always loved it, but you know, you look at it with a different eye. And one thing that struck me, how depressing it was that in the 2360s, that, you know, Starfleet is still run by the same white men whose paintings are on the walls in Bowdoin. Now, the reason I mention this is that I hope that that's something people can identify with, that obviously history is might be have been written by many white men, and no wonder they're the star players. But we know that history was, in fact, and is made by women and by people of very diverse backgrounds, and that it has been a struggle to recognize that. That's not something that has been given up easily. People have had to fight for that kind of recognition and for the proper place that everybody ought to have in our collective history. But it's also a very good analogy for how the question of Palestine has been talked about and spoken about, particularly in the United States, where there really has been one very dominant narrative, which many of us can probably recite by heart. And it's a narrative that has, unfortunately, written the Palestinians out of history. It's a narrative that has reduced the Palestinians to a role that is assigned for them as either terrorists or savages or interlopers, or, and this was really a feature of the last presidential election cycle in this country, where a number of Republican candidates were competing with each other to say that the Palestinians are an invented people. Now, those of you who study history and literary theory and critical theory and so on can understand that, you know, everyone, all peoples are invented in the sense that, nobody is people aren't born with a given story. That story has to be applied to them in a way. But singling out Palestinians this way by saying Palestinians are an invented people is a way to delegitimize them even further and to say that, in fact, you shouldn't pay attention to them. They don't exist. Their claims are insignificant and so on. So it's very hard for me to imagine another group of people in this country, another collective, being spoken about in that way in such mainstream discourse in the early 21st century. So for me, Palestine is very personal. I can tell you a little bit about my own personal connection to Palestine. Both of my parents were born in Palestine. My mother in a small village called Lifta, which is near Jerusalem, and my father in a village called Batir near Bethlehem, also not far from Jerusalem. And there's very little that's extraordinary about that. Many Palestinians have very similar backgrounds. It's very typical. My mother's village still exists. You can go and see the houses if you can get to Jerusalem. It's one of the few villages which Palestinians were forced to leave in 1948 where most of the houses are intact, and you have these beautiful examples of very old, sometimes hundreds of years old, vernacular architecture of that part of the world where people lived. And there's a struggle over Lifta now. It's even been in the news recently. There have been stories about it because I mentioned other villages. Most of the others were systematically destroyed after 1948, after Palestinians were forced to leave. Many of them were dynamited or bulldozed and then planted over with forests by the Jewish National Fund in order to essentially conceal the traces of where the Palestinian people had been. Lifta is one of the exceptions. And today I think it really symbolizes in a sense, the whole struggle over Palestine. There are people from Lifta. My mother is one of them, but there are people from Lifta all over the world. There's in the Chicago area where I live, there is something called the Lifta Association, where many people from Lifta gather for social events and so on. There are people from Lifta living just a few miles from Lifta and what is now East Jerusalem or the West Bank. And in the past few years, they have engaged in an effort to try to return to Lifta and reclaim it and to say, these are our homes, this is our land, and we have a right to be there. And so that has involved things like going back to Lifta, taking groups, taking younger people, and going back and, for example, cleaning the cemetery and tending the graveyard, because that's where the ancestors are buried and their graves have been neglected. And to assert that the people of Lifta have a right to go back, that they have a right to go back because they lived there, because it was their place of residence for generations, and also because there's personal property there, homes, land, and so on. On the other hand, what they're struggling against now is an Israeli plan to turn Lifta into a sort of a luxury resort or condominium complex, building the, taking the old houses and building them into sort of a luxury complex. And this would be for wealthy people, and it would be primarily for Jewish people. And the original owners of Lifta would not have it. Now, for the time being, an Israeli court has stayed this plan on technical grounds, but it's only a temporary reprieve. But the ultimate outcome can be either that the people of Lifta, that their rights are recognized, that they go home, that their property is restituted, or it can be that the process of colonization continues, and the process that has been going on for decades of land being what Israel calls Judaized continues, and that Lifta, just like so many other places, becomes a place for people who have more money, people who are of a particular ethno-religious group, and so on. And this symbolizes, I think, it encapsulates what this is really about. What right do the original inhabitants of the land have? What claims do those who are holding the land make? And what legitimacy do those claims have? Now, this process, we tend to talk about the situation in Palestine as something, that something happened in the past. And in some senses, that's true. A major year, a major date that you will hear talked about often is 1948. Israelis talk about this as the date of independence, of something to celebrate. Palestinians talk about it as the Nakba. Nakba is an Arabic word which means catastrophe. But it marks the year in which the vast majority of Palestinians were forcibly displaced from their land, something like 3/4 of the population at that time. And my mother was one of them. That's when her village of Lifta was forcibly depopulated and they became refugees. But it's important to understand the Nakba not as a historic event to be commemorated or a past wrong to be righted in the future, but it is very much an ongoing process. And it is a violent process. And so one thing that's gotten much less coverage in the news recently is something called the Prawer Plan, P-R-A-W-E-R, named after an Israeli official called, that's his name, Prawer. And basically, right now, 40,000 Palestinian Bedouins, these are traditionally nomadic people who live in the south of what is now Israel. It's the south of present-day Israel, are being faced with imminent expulsion from their traditional lands so that Israel can continue to claim this land for Jewish people. Now, an important point here is that these Bedouins who face this, and this is actually going on now, in August, Human Rights Watch issued a call on Israel to stop this process of demolishing the homes and settlements of Palestinian Bedouins and to stop the forcible removal from the land. But it's already going on. Much more is to come, sadly. What's important is that these Palestinian Bedouins are citizens of Israel because they live in the area that is now Israel. But that citizenship does not afford them any protection. And the reason for that is because Israel is the only state in the world, the only state in the world where citizenship is not defined in terms of nationality. So, I mean, to give you an analogy, on paper, in the United States, all citizens are equal. Now, we can argue about how true that is in practice, and that's a very important argument to have. But we understand that on paper, every citizen is supposed to be equal, regardless of their religion, regardless of whether they came here as an immigrant or whether they were born here, regardless of whether they're black, white, Asian, or anything else. Citizenship is citizenship. And that, of course, was not always true in this country. I know that in grade school we're taught that the United States has been a democracy for 200 plus years, but of course, by any objective standard, it's been a democracy at least, or let's say no further back than the 1960s. But we understand that today citizenship is supposed to be equal. In Israel, that's not the case. Citizenship depends on the government assigning you to one of a number of ethno-religious categories. So in the population registry in Israel, everyone is assigned a category, Jewish, Arab, Druze, Christian, etc. They have a certain list. And your rights depend on which category you're assigned to. And if you're Jewish, you have the most rights. If you're not Jewish, you have lesser rights. And there are something like 35 laws in Israel that distinguish, that privilege Jews over the other groups. And they're laws that have everything to do with access to land, to housing, to property, to immigration, and so, to marriage, and so on and so forth. Now, just in the past 2 weeks, a group of Israel, well, this happened more than 2 weeks ago, but the Supreme Court ruling came just 2 weeks ago. A group of 21 Israeli citizens, including Jews and Palestinian citizens of Israel, went to the Supreme Court to challenge this and to demand that their nationality be changed in the population registry to Israeli. Now, this sounds strange. You say the Israeli citizens, well, of course their nationality is Israeli, right? But that's not the case. Their nationality is Jewish or Arab or Druze. So they petitioned the court to have their nationality changed to Israeli and not to be assigned to an ethno-religious category. The Supreme Court rejected this petition. And this is, by the way, not the first ruling. There have been, since the 1970s, attempts to overturn this. And the Supreme Court ruled that, no, you cannot. That there is no such thing as an Israeli nationality. There is no Israeli nationality separate from the Jewish nationality, in Israel's terms. And that if we were to grant this petition and allow people to be registered as Israeli, then that would damage Israel's ability to remain what they call a Jewish and democratic state. So I'm going to say something about that because it's a crucial point, but I'm going to come back to it in a few minutes. So the situation of the Bedouins who I talked about is similar to Palestinians in the West Bank and similar to Palestinians all over the country who face this constant process, this continuing Nakba of removal from their land. And so, in a sense, the struggle I referred to over Lifta is one that can be seen throughout the country. Now, for the past more than 20 years, the conception that people have had of what peace looks like, or a peace process, has been very simple, or it starts with a conception that says, well, you have two groups of people and they can't live together, so each should have their own little country and they should be separated. And that's an idea that that for many people is very attractive. It has the advantage of simplicity. It seems logical. It absolves us of the need to worry about, well, why can't they get along? I mean, we just accept they can't get along, and so, you know, give everyone their own little space, and then they won't have to fight with each other. But it's a formula that hasn't worked. And it hasn't worked because it doesn't address the fundamental process that I've been talking about, which is that it's not a conflict between two equal sides. It's not a static situation where you have two groups of people and they're just sitting there staring angrily at each other like the guys in the paintings in the hallway, staring at each other across the hallway. But it is an ongoing violent process of colonization. And it's a process of colonization that has also met with constant Palestinian resistance. And the resistance is what always gets talked about as terrorism. That any resistance from the indigenous people is automatically defined as terrorism. Whether or not it's something that we would ourselves consider to be terrorism. And of course, the term terrorism is one that's very politicized. It's not one that describes a term. If I say to you, if this is a cup of cider, hot cider, and it's quite good, if I say this is cider, you know what I mean by cider. I mean, there are different varieties of cider, but we understand that it's basically, you know, liquid that comes from pressed apples. Could be hot, it could be cold, it could be alcoholic, it could be non-alcoholic, but we have a common understanding of what cider is. With terrorism, terrorism isn't like that. Terrorism, you know, you could have exactly the same act, but if it's carried out by one type of person, we call it terrorism. If it's carried out by another kind of person, we call it self-defense. We call it a police action. You know, we have all kinds of other polite words for it. So it's important to understand the political nature of describing Palestinian resistance in any form as terrorism. But the process of resistance, which has primarily been nonviolent, incidentally, it has also been constant, just like the colonization has been constant. And sadly, because Israel has so much more power in its hands than the Palestinians, even though Palestinians have resisted this process, the same way Native Americans resisted. But that resistance did not ultimately halt the process of colonization. There are very few examples of Native Americans actually driving settlers out of their lands in North America. It happened for a few decades, the indigenous people in what is now New Mexico succeeded in driving Spanish settlers out, and the Spanish settlers weren't able to return for several decades. But that's an isolated example. There aren't that many examples of that. And ultimately, of course, the settlers came back. And for Palestinians, too, resistance in any form, violence, nonviolence, armed struggle, political struggle, whatever you want, has not succeeded in halting the process of colonization. And so when you talk about this notion of dividing land and saying we're going to have two states, I always like to use a very simple analogy, which is that we're not talking about something that is static. So if instead of thinking about a complicated situation like Palestine-Israel, you think about two people discussing how to slice a pizza and negotiating over how to slice a pizza. Well, that negotiation could have a number of parameters. It could be based on who paid more for the pizza, who worked harder that day, who's hungrier, who likes pepperoni, who doesn't. I mean, you could agree a whole list of criteria for how to negotiate over the pizza. But a problem arises if one of the two parties is eating the pizza as fast as he can while the discussions are going on. And, I mean, it is kind of funny, but the tragedy is this has been the reality of the so-called peace process, is that Palestinians who are relatively powerless have been asked to come and negotiate with Israel over how to divide their land while Israel is busy colonizing the land as fast as it can. And so we have this really farcical situation now where supposedly peace talks are happening while Israel every other day is announcing new Jewish-only settlements on Palestinian land. And obviously that will go nowhere. It simply functions as a cover for continued theft of Palestinian land. So how can we unravel this? A fundamental problem I've identified is the ongoing process of colonization. That's a process that depends on the existence of a vast disparity in power between Israelis on the one hand and Palestinians on the other. But this disparity, of course, exists in a bigger context, a regional context and a global context. And just to keep it very simple, a major part of that context is the fact that the most powerful side, Israel, has the support of the world's biggest power, the United States. So it's an even more lopsided balance. So those are the conditions that allow the colonization process to continue. The point I want to come back to now, which is Israel makes a central claim, and it's hard to go into it in the detail it deserves while sticking to the time limit I've given myself, but I will simply try to introduce it as briefly as I can. We can come back in the discussion. Israel claims that it has a right to exist as a Jewish state, and that any ultimate outcome must guarantee Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. Well, this is a position that has been effectively endorsed by the United States. What does this mean in practice? Well, first of all, we have to ask, how did Israel become a Jewish state? I've already alluded to that, and I won't go into great detail, but it was a process of violent gerrymandering. And I should say, what do we mean by a Jewish state? In practice, I mean, there are many definitions, but the most important one is a state in which, one, Jews are a numerical majority, and two, because of that numerical majority, they can legitimize giving superior rights to those who are designated by the government or by the state as Jews. So it's democratic, you know, it's sort of the antithesis of what we're taught in civics. It's like, we say the tyranny of the majority. That's what they're saying here, is that because we're a majority, we have the right to vote ourselves whatever special privileges we would like to have. And so this majority came about through violent gerrymandering, through the expulsion and flight of the Palestinian people in 1948, and then not allowing them to return. So that's the important point. How it's maintained, this is now crucial. So the simple analogy I'd like to give is if we say that Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish state, I mean, what is a right? Does anyone want to volunteer a definition of a right? Does Bowdoin have a law school? No, right? It's a liberal arts college. There's no law school here. But basically, there's a foundational legal maxim that there is no right without a remedy. In other words, if you claim you have a right to something, then if someone violates that right, you must be able to have redress for that right. So if somebody steals my cup of cider, I should have legitimate redress for that. I should be able to go to court, have them return the cider. If they've drunk it, to replace the cider, they may be punished. There may be some injunction to prevent them from stealing my cider in the future. Now, it has to be a proper remedy. What does that mean? It means that it's not a proper remedy for me to go and, you know, I might feel satisfied doing it, but I can't just go and take a jug of hot cider and pour it on their head. That wouldn't be a proper remedy. So when you talk about right, there has to be a remedy, and it has to be a proper remedy. So the question then, in terms of Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state, is what can threaten this right? And the Israelis are very clear about this. They say that if there are too many Palestinians, then we'll lose the majority. Israel will stop being a Jewish state, would have to become, horror of all horrors, a democracy. And so the question then you have to ask is what legitimate means does Israel have to enforce this so-called right? Now, one which they claim is the right to prevent Palestinian refugees from returning home. So they claim that our right to have a Jewish majority trumps the rights of refugees that are recognized everywhere else in the world to go back to the places that they were forced to leave. So you have to decide, is that legitimate? That's number one. But it doesn't stop there. I have mentioned that this might be strange, but some Palestinians are citizens of Israel. The reason for that is not all Palestinians were expelled in 1948. About 10% remained behind, and they were eventually given citizenship, though not full rights, again, because, as I explained, they're not Jewish, but citizens. And today, there are about 1.4 million Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, and other Palestinians are not citizens of Israel. I'll come to that in a minute. But Israel has imposed a number of discriminatory laws against its Palestinian citizens. Again, in the name of defending this right to exist as a Jewish state. So one law which they passed in originally in 2002, in 2003, is called the... These were amendments to what it calls the Nationality and Entry into Israel Law. And it still exists now. And basically, if we come back to the United States, in this country, if you, as a man or a woman, were to fall in love with a man or a woman from another country, you have the right, under U.S. laws, for your spouse to come and live with you. With the recent changes and the striking down of DOMA, that may now extend, as some other countries have, to same-sex partnerships, but I don't think it has yet. But it's long been established that you have the right to bring your spouse to live in the United States. There are certain procedures and residency requirements. You know, you have to live here for 3 years before you get citizenship and so on. But basically, these laws apply to everyone equally. It doesn't matter where your spouse is from. They could be from, you know, Haiti or Ireland or Iran, and the law applies the same way. Under the Israeli law, they said that you can bring your spouse to Israel except if they're Palestinian. Except if they're Palestinian. And who does this target? It targets Palestinian citizens of Israel who tend to marry Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza or from Jordan or from Lebanon who are not citizens of Israel. And Israeli leaders were very explicit at the time in saying, well, you may not like it, but we have a right to be a Jewish state. And if we have all these Palestinians marrying other Palestinians and coming here and having children, then that threatens our right to exist as a Jewish state. So I could give you many more examples, but I won't. But the point of that example is I hope it puts into stark relief what the implications are of what you claim, of when you claim that a state has a right to a certain demographic makeup. This would be like Maine defining itself, or the United States defining itself as a Christian and democratic state. Now, you may say that the history of the country has effectively been that way, but the way we've been moving, or the way we've been struggling to move, is away from that and towards inclusion. When I talk about this notion of having a nationality that is not an American nationality, that would be like each one of us having in our American passports, if we have an American passport or whatever passport we may have, that our nationality is not American or British or Lebanese would be a good example where they have this sectarian system, but where instead our nationality is white or Christian or Jewish or whatever else. And I think we understand that's not something that is acceptable. Israel claims that it's exceptional and it ought to be able to discriminate in this way. I would argue otherwise. Now, so I have talked about the continuing process of colonization. I've talked about Israel's claim that it has a right to be a Jewish state, which I would argue in practice means a right to be racist against Palestinians and others, but primarily against Palestinians. And so then the question is, what's the answer to this? And how do we get there? I would argue that the answer is not a division of the pizza. I would argue that the answer is ending the process of colonization and beginning a process of decolonization. And what does that mean in practice? It certainly means ending the violent Judaization of land. It means beginning a process where Palestinians who have been excluded are allowed to return. It means a process of building a new basis for everybody in the country, Palestinians, Israeli Jews, and others, to live as equals. And it means a political framework that can protect to the maximum extent possible the rights of everyone. And that includes, of course, the right to practice their religion, to nurture their own culture, and to live the way they see fit without impinging on the rights of others. Tomorrow in Middlebury, I'm going to be giving a talk that focuses on more on that. It focuses on the question of, is this possible? And how could you get there? And that's something we can talk about more in the Q&A. I won't have time to go into that level of detail here. But what I will argue tomorrow in Middlebury, and in fact I'll argue in a book that I've just finished that should be coming out in the spring, is that this is possible, and we've seen it happen, or we've seen the process begin to happen in places including South Africa and Northern Ireland, and I go into that in greater depth. And what it involves is a couple of things, a couple of basic principles that we can point out, is that the dominant group, whether that is whites in apartheid South Africa, Protestant unionists in Northern Ireland, or Israeli Jews in historic Palestine, will have to give up their claim to privileged and special status, will have to give up their control of the state, will have to give up the mentality and privileges of settler colonialism. In exchange for that, they would be indigenized as citizens in a state, in a civil state. What we also learn from South Africa and to an extent from Northern Ireland and other places, but those are the two examples I focus on, is that this is incredibly difficult and that there are real pitfalls. One of the common and correct criticisms of the post-1994 settlement in South Africa, 1994, of course, was the year the formal white minority regime ended and was replaced with a one-person, one-vote system, and Nelson Mandela was elected president. But one of the criticisms, or a key criticism, is that the black majority gained political rights and political equality, but the white minority maintained its hold on the economy, and so black people haven't really obtained true equality, and that decolonization has not really taken place. And that's very true. And I think that's a criticism that we don't need to travel as far as South Africa in order to make. I think the United States is a perfectly good example of that, where we're all very proud of the achievements of the civil rights era, although some of them, there have been concerted efforts to undo them, including the recent decision by the Supreme Court to nullify parts of the Voting Rights Act. But in general, there's a consensus. You know, nobody in public life in the United States would ever think about calling for the restoration of Jim Crow. It's unthinkable. That system has been completely delegitimized. But the question remains about whether liberal rights, saying everyone is equal, everyone can vote, has actually resulted in practical equality when you look at the really deep and lasting disparities in this country that are still so clear along racial lines. And it's down to the point of, on average, you will live longer if you're white. You live a longer life, a healthier life, and a richer life on average. That's still true. And that's systemic. And so the question then is, what can we learn from those experiences so that you build into a political process or a political settlement the kinds of processes of restitution and real deep decolonization that, number one, ethically bring people to a similar level, and at the same time create a common basis of citizenship so that people can begin to identify with each other. But I'm optimistic it can happen. I could have spent the time telling you a lot more about the catastrophic situation that Palestinians face, particularly in Gaza, where I traveled in May, and I can say more about that in the Q&A if you're interested. And I could come up with 1,000 reasons why this should be impossible. But my own experience, and talking to Palestinians everywhere, is that I think there is a continued thirst for justice, not a thirst for revenge. And that has to be the basis of a future settlement. In the final couple of minutes, I want to address what our role can be in this country and what our role on campuses can be and in civil society. And I think we can play a very big role. When we were discussing at lunch today, I was remembering that when I was in a university in the late 1980s, early 90s, the solidarity struggle against apartheid in South Africa was very strong on American campuses. And in many campuses, including mine, students would build mock townships, mock shanties on campus in the quads to educate other students about what was happening in South Africa. And a key component of the campaign was the call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And the logic of this is very straightforward, that if you have a regime doing odious things, you shouldn't be complicit. You shouldn't support it. And if you can do things that weaken it, you ought to do them. So the call was on universities to withdraw their, universities have big endowments and pension funds, and they have lots and lots of money, and they invest it. And so the call was on universities to pull out of companies that were doing business in South Africa or profiting from the apartheid system. And today there's a similar call from Palestinians to people around the world, help us. Support our struggle. Understand that Israel is here in terms of power and we're here. And that you can't really have dialogue, you can't have negotiations when you have such a huge imbalance of power. And so there are different ways to bring about a balance. One might be armed struggle. But if you want to avoid bloodshed, if you want to ease the path of the future, then you have to have some kind of struggle that's ethical, but at the same time can begin to challenge that balance of power. And so in 2005, 170 Palestinian organizations got together and they issued a call on people around the world to impose boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaigns on Israel, similar to those that had been used against South Africa, until three basic demands are met. One, that Israel ends its military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Two, that Israel ends the kinds of discrimination I mentioned and others against Palestinian citizens of Israel. And three, that Israel respects the right of Palestinian refugees to come home even if they're not Jews. And so those three basic demands are rooted in universal principles of human rights and international law. And the campaign has really been gaining a lot of steam. And it's really generated a huge backlash, with large national organizations spending a lot of money to try to malign this movement, to try to claim it's anti-Semitic, to try to claim that boycott, divestment and sanctions is, you know, anti-peace or anti-dialogue, that it hurts people's feelings, a whole lot of propaganda like that. Of course, it's very important for all of us to emphasize clearly and repeatedly that the Palestinian struggle is not a struggle against Jews or Jewish people, and the Jewish people are not the oppressors of Palestinians. The oppressors of Palestinians is the Israeli state and those who support it and who are complicit in it. And in the struggle against this oppression and the struggle to create an alternative that is inclusive of everyone, there are also people of all backgrounds. There are many Jewish people. There are LGBT people, particularly in the struggles on campuses in the U.S. This is an important point because Israel has been trying to fight back by a strategy that some have called pinkwashing, which is to paint Israel as this haven for LGBT rights amid this sort of Middle Eastern ocean of intolerance, and therefore to say to LGBTQ people, you should overlook what Israel is doing to Palestinians because, you know, Israel is such a wonderful place to come for a vacation and go to nightclubs in Tel Aviv. That's a very divisive kind of politics where you try to play one group off against another. But I think that I don't think it's succeeding. So I'll end by saying that what I hope that you'll do, especially those of you who aren't very familiar with this topic, is when you hear arguments about it or when you read something about it, to keep these things in mind, to ask yourself a number of questions. Who has the power in this situation? Who has the strength? Who can impose on others a reality? If you're in the position of those who are the weakest, what options would you have? What would you do in their situation? And finally, ask yourself, is there anything you can do? If you care about all the people in this situation, Palestinians and Israelis, what can you do to help them get out of it? You're very fortunate to have on campus a really wonderful group of students for Justice in Palestine, who I've really enjoyed spending time with. But they're an amazing resource. And I hope that for those of you who are curious, that you will get in touch with them, go out to dinner with them, attend future events, and begin to ask some of the questions that, you know, we will never have time to fully explore in a meeting of an hour and a half or so. So let me stop there, and then I would love to open it up to everyone.
You have been listening to Palestinian journalist Ali Abu Nima speaking at Bowdoin University. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.